This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again, Sentinels of the Multiverse, a cooperative superhero card game, and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hey, this is Stephen Ratty McFarlane, one of the biggest nerds in the world, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we'll wade through the editions, provide some advice, and design a Blindheim.
We are joined in this episode by Stephen Radney McFarland, or SRM, as he's commonly known around the interwebs, a game designer who's been in the industry for some time and works for both Wizards of the Coast and Paizo, as if that's possible. And of course, Tracy's best friend.
Yeah. He and I are BFFs now forever.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they got together in Seattle the other week when she missed out on the Morden Kanan's episode and exchanged friendship bracelets and everything.
Yeah, it was awesome. Well, we not only exchanged friendship bracelets, we braided them ourselves.
Excellent.
And we made friendship minis.
Beautiful. So we're going to be talking to him in a little bit, but first some news. We covered some pretty cool and exciting news, I guess, in the last episode when Tracy was gone, and that was kind of fun, but I don't know how much more we have other than I want to mention honotogrowabemo.org, the website where I have in the last several years grown a beard and raised money for breast cancer research. Keep an eye on that, and if you're interested in helping us out or seeing those things or donating to help fund research to put an end to breast cancer, go there. Anyway, it is also worth mentioning, I guess, as news, that for the next few months, you're also going to be hearing a new sponsor. We have a new second sponsor, Sentinels of the Multiverse, a game by a company called Greater Than Games. It is a cooperative card game with 3 to 5 players that form a team of superpowered heroes that battle one of the 4 villains that come in the deck. And so you've got lots of different heroes you can choose from to form different types of teams, and then you've also got several different villains to choose from, so there's a lot of replayability sort of built into those concepts. But it sounds like a fun game to me, and check it out.
Yeah.
Greater Than Games is all about making the games that we've always wanted to play. We love playing games, and we love our ridiculous process of game creation. The most important thing to us is to make the sorts of games we want to play available to everyone. Go to sentinelsofthemultiverse.com for more information.
So now we're here with Stephen Radney McFarland, also known as SRM by many. Stephen, what do you do?
So currently, I do a lot of stuff, but currently I am a designer for the Pathfinder role-playing game at Paizo. And I also write a column for Dungeon Magazine called Save My Game. Every once in a while, I teach game design at some local colleges and schools, and then I do other stuff like paint miniatures and other nerdy things as well.
Now, wait a minute. You just said that you are a designer at Paizo.
That is true.
And that you also write a regular article for Dungeon Magazine.
Yep.
Now, it sounds to me like you're involved in two different editions, and I believe there's a war on, and you can't do that.
Oh, no, no. Absolutely you can. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that sit there and say you've got to take one side of the fence or the other. I like Pathfinder a lot. I like 4E a lot. I play in Pathfinder games. I play in 4E games. I switch back and forth. Sometimes it's confusing. I often call sense motive insight and vice versa, but I see more similarities in the games, two games, than I see differences most of the time.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say, he even ran a Pathfinder game for me when I was out in Seattle.
I did. It was it was fun. I got to swallow people with gelatinous cubes and
attack them with giant amoebas.
Yeah, I ran a slightly modified version of the adventure that I wrote for Pathfinder Society called Delve the Dungeon Deep. I added back in the gelatinous cube that the developer took out.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. I know you really enjoyed that.
Yeah, you know, like, most of the party was captured in the cube. That was awesome. And they're like, why hasn't the rogue taken any damage yet? That's because I'm a rogue.
It's because you're a rogue and you stayed away. Yeah. So that might have been a little bit more than they could handle, but I had fun. And they survived.
Very good. So it sounds like you've been jumping the fence back and forth between the edition wars for a while, and I know that's I understand that's a topic that you like to converse about regularly, the concept of surviving the transition or the edition wars, as they are called.
Right.
What are your sort of thoughts on that?
Well, first thing is you should play the games you want to play, right? I mean, if you really like Pathfinder and you didn't much care for 4th edition, play Pathfinder, and vice versa. If you like both of them, if you've got friends who play both, right, just do that. I know it's very popular for gamers to kind of define themselves sometimes by the things that they don't like, but I think you should just go out and have a good time. That's what games are for.
So that's pretty in line with my philosophy that I've had for a long time, that there is no edition wars. There's just jerks in the internet.
Well, that used to be.
Does that sound accurate?
There are jerks on the internet.
Okay.
I've heard that rumor somewhere.
Okay.
Anyway, but yeah, I think most people who sit there and play their games at home, they have no horse in that race, right? They don't care. They like to go over to the friend's house once a week, kill some monsters, engage in some great story, and get some treasure and level up. I think it is overblown within the internet echo chamber.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. So you also mentioned Beyond Edition Wars that you teach game design.
I do. I've taught game design at the Art Institute of Seattle and the International Academy of Design and Technology, also here in Seattle. A little bit of theory, mechanics, user interface, sometimes level design. I like teaching a lot. It's a lot of fun. I get to sort of help the new generation of game designers get started and teach them about these crazy tabletop games, which they may have heard of, but they think are lame until they start playing them, and they're like, oh my god, these things are awesome. That part is always a heck of a lot of fun.
So a lot of the students you're teaching are video game designers who are, you're giving them a different perspective on game design? Is that sort of the way that works?
I wouldn't say I'm giving them a different perspective on game design, as I'm sort of uncovering a curtain that they didn't realize about game design. A lot of times when I get these younger students who've mostly played computer games, they don't understand that there are mechanics behind computer games, and I sort of show them through tabletop design and by studying different aspects of computer game design that you actually have to build a game behind it. You know, there's a lot of flash and boom and bang, but there are mechanics, and you've got to tell programmers how to put those together, and you have to design the game like you would a tabletop game, even for a computer game, though they have different rules.
Right. I know some of the articles I've loved reading the most that you've written are the ones of talking about your students, and there's the one about the old video game. I'm forgetting the name of it right now, but you had to read the book to find stuff.
Oh, yeah. I'm not quite sure which game that was. No,
I don't remember.
There's a lot of those things. You had to read the manual or the book to find certain things. And
right.
That's not part of current video game design at all. They want everything to be intuitive and seamless, and you don't have to read a manual.
And you like using magic a lot to teach intro game stuff, I thought?
Yeah, there's... two games that I like to use Magic a little bit, because some of these younger gamers played a little bit of Magic or Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh when they were younger, and it's easy to show them mechanics in that way because they play those games just didn't think about the mechanics. The other one I really like to use is a game, Wings of War, because it really shows them what you can do with tabletop pieces that they probably didn't consider before. It's one of those eureka games that a lot of my students play, and then they go, oh, I didn't even know you could do that with cards, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check that one out.
It is a very good game. An Italian company produced it, and Fantasy Flight brought it over to the United States.
Is that the one where you're building the plane?
You're not really building the plane. You're building it's a World War One sort of flight simulator war game, and you have to plot your course, almost like Robo Rally, but a little bit more freeform.
Okay. Cool. And I have to say, you look the part of the professor. You know, you're the exact sort of person I would expect to see sitting, standing behind a podium and lecturing to an auditorium full of kids.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Are you referencing his hair?
Yeah, my long hair and my propensity to dress in black t-shirts and jeans. Yeah, sure.
Well, with your jacket, though, too.
Well, yeah, with my jacket. Yeah, my
very professorial.
Professorial, yeah, absolutely.
Maybe I'm just jealous because I used to have the hair, and now I'm not quite that long, but I used to have longer hair, and I've since lost it.
So one of the fun things is I look a lot younger than I actually am. People are always shocked to find out how old I am, and I won't say how old I am on here because I don't like telling people. But a lot of times, mostly when I started teaching, I would sit down in one of the seats and wait for the students to come in, because a lot of them were younger kids, there were also people coming back to school to study game design. And then I would get up, and they would always be a little shocked that I was actually one of the professors.
Very cool. Well, I suppose we should take a quick break from getting to know you and talk about our sponsor before we get into our advice and design bits. So at this point, we're going to talk about our longtime sponsor, Noble Knight Games. They're an online store. They're a brick-and-mortar store. So if you want to get the online discounts but support a local store, Noble Knight is a good choice for you, and they specialize in finding things that are out of print. But they also have new material, like a certain book called Ultimate Combat that somebody on the line with us, I think, has some insight into.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time working on this book and am still spending a lot of time working on this book as I work on the updates and errata for the next printing. Basically, it's got everything you want for combat, for Pathfinder, over 250 new feats, the ninja, the samurai, and the gunslinger classes, vehicle rules, variant combat stuff, even some spells that allow your spellcasting folk to engage in combat more easily.
So it sounds like a big book of crunch.
It is a big book of crunch. There is not a whole lot of fluff in it, but I hear the kids like crunch.
But it has the gunslinger.
It does have the gunslinger, which was an absolute blast to design. It's how do you make a gun class work in the assumptions of Pathfinder and make it fun. And that it was difficult. I think we've got a pretty good balance, though. And it's one of those classes that people either really love or they go, why are you putting guns in my fantasy role-playing game? And I can't do much for the other folks. But I'm glad that the folks that are playing it are having a good time.
Right on. And it sounds like there's some interesting design things there that people of mini games could probably look at and think about. For their games, you know. I know many fantasy role-playing games suffer from vehicle rules that aren't quite easy to use and what have you, or they don't quite do what you want them to do. And so, you know, I'm always a big fan of looking everywhere for things to cut and paste into your games.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the vehicle rules were especially sort of challenging because you can get too complex with vehicle rules really easily, and then vehicle rules always have the problem that they add facing to a game that one of its assumptions is it doesn't have any facing. But vehicles are really good at going one direction really quickly, and you have to sort of replicate that in the game. So, yeah, if you want to take a look at it, and because you're having trouble with vehicles in your game, you'll at least find some really good ideas on how to adjudicate vehicles in whatever game you're playing.
Very cool, and it is available at Noble Knight for $5 off. That is about $35 available right now. Go out and get it.
Buy multiple copies if you want. All right, one's fine.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, so let's get back into it here with Stephen Radney McFarland, and we're going to DM advice it up over here. We primarily have a 4th edition D&D audience, but I think there's a lot of advice that can be both 4th edition specific and a lot of advice that can be very general and work for many different games. And you do a lot of DM advice discussions over with your article, Save My Game, on Dungeon Magazine, yes?
Yeah, that's basically all that column is about is DM advice.
So what kind of advice do you typically see that people need the most often?
So the first thing I would say, mostly for new DMs, is just don't be so nervous, right? There is a lot of folks are afraid of getting stuff wrong, and so they don't jump in the DM pool because they're like, well, what if I get stuff wrong? And my advice to them is, don't worry, you will get stuff wrong. And you will learn from those mistakes, and you will find your way into situations where you'll make grand mistakes that will enlighten you about your players and the game, and move forward with that. So don't be afraid to make mistakes. You will. You'll learn from them, and you'll make a better game in the long run.
I make mistakes all the time.
I don't make mistakes. Okay.
Yeah,
but only because I have a rules lawyer who sits next to me as a player, and anytime there's a question, I make him adjudicate it.
Oh, having a co DM like that is absolutely a good idea sometimes. He's not allowing a certain amount of discussion as well.
Yeah, and he's not really a co DM so much as he's just. I mean, he had never played D&D when we met him.
Okay,
but he came in as a Magic player, and then so he was already very rules specific sort of focused,
right?
And then once we introduced him to D&D, he couldn't get enough of it, and so he's at the game store 3-4 nights a week doing encounters or living games or whatever, just and just voraciously eats it all up, and so he's probably logged more hours of D&D play in his 3-4 years of playing than I did in the previous 15.
Very cool.
So he's become my rules expert. Because he's seen it all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, the more you play, play a lot as well. It's hard for GMs because a lot of times they feel like they have to prepare every single encounter. But go out and find pre-made adventures. You don't have to write every single one yourself. Steal wherever you can. Because if somebody else has done the work for you and you like that work and you think that would fit in your campaign really well, it's much easier to modify it than to try to come up with, an idea every single weekend. Your players, even if they know, won't care because they're having a good time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of advice do you have for somebody who's a little bit more of a veteran DM? For example, myself, right?
Okay.
I listen to some of the shows with like Chris Perkins DMing stuff, right? And I pick up some of the things that he's doing that I'm not doing at my table, and it's like, man, I wish I could, as a DM, incorporate that much description into my combats, or do some of the voices and some of the role play for the NPCs that sort of help bring the whole world to alive. But then I get to, I fully intend on doing it, and then I sit down at the table, and I feel kind of silly because I've never done it before, and these guys have gotten used to a certain gaming style, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Chris is such a great DM, just in general, and he does a lot with very little. If you really sit there and listen to Chris, and I have, he really doesn't give you a ton of description, but the description he does give you is always very important, always very spot on. He's been doing this for such a long time and been doing it so well that he knows the exact amount of information you need to get that fire in your head going. And I think that's important. A lot of times GMs will sit there and decide to describe the city that you just arrived, and 15 minutes later, as the players are checking their iPhones, they wonder why they've lost their audience. I think the biggest piece of advice I would give to you is always realize that the players around you are your audience. They're not your guinea pigs. They will absolutely find other things to do if you're not entertaining them. You should always challenge them and entertain them, but you should always think, what is the best thing for me to do in my game that will make them have a good time? Because if you're doing it for yourself, or you're doing it for some imaginary crowd out there, you're designing a world and you eventually want it published, you have a good chance of losing the players that are sitting around your table every week.
Yeah, right on. And I think at the same time, the DM also has to keep in mind that as much as you're doing it for them, you are doing it for yourself a little bit. I mean,
oh yeah,
the DM has to have fun at the table too.
Yeah, that does kind of go with the assumption that if you really don't like DMing, don't DM. There's nothing worse than a DM who really feels like they have to do it. And working in organized play for many years and having to grab people and say, please, can you run this table? Unless they were really enthusiastic about running a game, those folks were usually our worst DMs. Just because if you don't enjoy it, nobody else is going to enjoy it either. So, yeah, ask yourself the very simple question, do I really want a DM? And if the answer is no, find a DM who will run you through fun games and who really loves to do it.
And also, like you were saying with the description and stuff, sometimes just giving them enough to pretend that it's a box and then they can make stuff up about it, I found to be really nice. It depends on the group, of course, but...
Right, and a lot of times it's be flexible as well. Don't fall in love with your own plan sometimes, because players will pick that up and do something that you think's totally awesome, and you're almost like, oh, wow, why didn't I think of that? That is a great idea. And the great thing about being the DM is you can sit there and go, you know, it was my idea.
that's part of the stealing.
Well, right, yeah, absolutely. If you do it too often, players will start to catch on, but doing it every once in a while on when it counts is pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah, and players will surprise you. And sometimes I guess my advice for that is occasionally players will surprise you in a way that you're really not prepared for, and then that might be a good time to end the game for the night, you know, and give yourself a little bit of time. No, my first 4th edition adventure that I ran, I had some, the players went into a cave, they fought some insect things, there were some Kruthix inside, they killed the Kruthix, and I sort of described that there were collapsed tunnels going deeper down into the ground, sort of to explain how the Kruthix even got there, right, because they're burrowing creatures, and I figure they collapsed. And the players were expected then to leave and re-enter slavery, right? Because they were slaves before, they were sent in to do this job and they were supposed to come back out. And they decided that they would rather spend 3 days digging down those collapsed tunnels into the Underdark as first level characters.
Oh, yeah.
In order to avoid being slaves. And I'm like, really? You're choosing certain death over going back into slavery? Okay.
And never underestimate a person's will to get out of slavery.
Yeah.
Apparently. I had this whole campaign planned where the entire first tier, you know, the heroic tier of a campaign arc was going to be working within the bounds of slavery and eventually escaping. And they got away at level two. And then I had to figure out, okay, so how do they go through the Underdark and not end up dead? You know?
Right.
And that changed the whole tenor of the campaign, but not in a bad way. It actually went very well.
A friend of mine has always insists that PC doesn't stand for player character; it stands for plot corrupter.
Yeah.
And I think he's right in a certain way. But yeah, and over time you find out. Anytime you try to imprison characters, their players go, no, we're not having any of that. You try to enslave them, it's like, how can we get out of here as quick as possible? Right. If you just give them the hint of treasure, they're there, you know, like flies on, well, you know. Absolutely. So part of it is not only knowing over time what really makes people excited when they're playing the game, or what they want to avoid or what they want to go after, but realizing what your players, their particular quirks as well.
Well, yeah, and actually that ties into sort of a larger concept, I think. I find that if you as a DM can figure out what entices that player or that character specifically, then you don't. Then it, you can railroad the party without ever letting them realize you're railroading the party, right? I mean, you can say, you have all these options, but I know you're going to go that way because you're really interested in that thing over there, you know? You just make one option, one that they really are, that you know they're going to choose, because that's what their whole thing is.
And they'll fool you every once in a while, but like in one of the games that I run, I know that any time, it works like clockwork, and it's almost like a compulsion. Any time I have a pit, no matter how dangerous or deadly, one character jumps in every single time. His player is just fixated. I don't know why. And the rest of the group doesn't know why either. And they're like, thanks, Steven, for putting in another pit and getting us in trouble. And I'm like, well, it's a great adventure starter for your group. It really is, because Rob will jump in every time. A lot of times when people complain about railroading in adventures, it's usually because the writer sits there and goes, well, why wouldn't they go on this, right? They, you know, you have assumptions, and sometimes those assumptions are made by the people playing in your game. And, you know, and players and even GMs that sit there and read those things go, well, you're not the boss of me. That's not what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, run it. See what happens. You may be surprised.
Right, I think that's right. And for what, at least for my group, what I've found more often than not, if I can get the players and get their characters invested into a story, you know, do something with their character to make them very important or special in some element of the story, then I've created my own motivation for them. Right, I've given them a reason to be. You know, make them the prophesied hero of this town or whatever, but give them something that makes them special somewhere doing something or along some lines. And all of a sudden you've got an instant hook that will drag them onto whatever rails you want to put them on. And it'll be completely their choice to be on those rails.
Oh yeah. I mean, and some of the best treasure you can give folks is just status within the kingdom, right? If you were the king's champion, all of a sudden you can railroad them any which way you want. Well, you are the king's champion. You probably should do this sort of statements. And they feel really important. They're like, you know, they can swagger into a tavern and say, you will answer my questions because I'm the king's champion. And, you know, all of a sudden that +3 sword that they were very excited about, it's like, it's just giving me a bonus. Whatever. Watch this. I'm the king's champion.
Yeah. Right.
I pulled that a lot. I played a Templar in a Dark Sun game. And I ran all over tier just ordering everybody to do whatever I said. And it seldom worked, but it was brilliant. I mean, that guy was so arrogant. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing how often you can drop little things into a game and folks can get just really, really excited about it. Like, you know, maybe crowns.
I was going to wonder.
I mean, there was just this throwaway item in the Pathfinder game we played last weekend and
my character got it.
Yeah, Tracy got it, wore it, tried to use it.
Yeah, I wore it, and we had this katana blade that end a trade agreement.
And a trade agreement.
That promised soldiers, so it's like, man, I'm setting myself up to become queen.
I know, she did the bad thing. It just ran off with them, and now she's running some petty barony somewhere in the world.
Yeah, I don't have the katana anywhere, but I've got promise to soldiers somewhere.
Right. So a second level rogue has a small barony that's probably going to get its butt kicked by pirates. And flourish under the wise rulership.
Wise.
They'll probably overthrow her. How does she have the money to pay for an army?
She's a rogue.
Yeah, she'll steal it from her people.
From them?
Barony, we mean small group in the woods.
Yeah. She'll put together a bank. She'll call it Wall Street, and she'll just start money left and right from the little critters that live in the woods. It's like, oh, you only have 5 acorns? That's fine. We'll take those.
Brilliant. All right. So any other DM advice you want to give? Anything that you think all DMs out there should probably know about in order to be awesome?
I would say, and it's something that I've said numerous times in Save My Game, and I still say it, is always saying yes is a skill. Anytime your players ask, hey, can we do it? I mean, within reason, it's like, can I be a god at third level? Yeah, it's probably not the way the game works. But if they want to try something that is interesting and fun and makes them feel heroic, find a way to say yes. It doesn't mean you have to make it easy. You can make it challenging, but you should always try to make fun whenever possible.
And you did that in our game when I tried to blind the Blindheim with my cloak.
Yeah. I mean, that was relatively easy. Okay, so you've got your cloak out. You want to make a grapple check. It wasn't easy, and you didn't succeed it, but there was a possibility that you could, and that would have been absolutely awesome. But the idea itself is great.
And that's something that I think ties into one of the bits of DM advice that I always try to espouse, is that you need to make sure to talk to your players and as often as possible, so they know that there's sort of this open door policy of, if there's something you want to try or do or whatever, please feel free to bring it up, you know, because a lot of people will approach that situation of, well, there's no rule for how I blind this creature with my cloak, so clearly it can't be done,
right?
But you know, I think it's good to say, you know what, I'd like to try this. What do I have to do to make that happen? And then give them a decent shot at doing it, you know, because it is fun and it is interesting. And why wouldn't you be able to take a cloak and try to throw it over something's head or whatever?
No, absolutely. And, you know, in the rules is sort of as much as we try to put together a nice, complete set of rules that contain every single thing that you could possibly do. It's played by a bunch of creative people who watch a lot of movies and read comic books and novels and stuff like that. And they're always going to find something that you're going to sit there and go, oh, that's interesting, but I don't know how to do it. The trick is find a way and quickly. And again, don't be afraid of being wrong. I mean, because you're going into sort of new design territory with the role-playing game. Just find a way to do it, and you can always refine that process later if the player wants to do it again and again and again, or whatever, and build a new power or create a new feat or a magic item that helps them out and does it. But yeah, just say yes. It's fun. It's easy. It'll do your game a lot of good.
But sometimes say yes, but make it hard.
Oh yeah, it doesn't mean so, yeah.
Sometimes you can say yes, but they'll wish you had just said no.
Yeah. Which can also be fun, because that also sometimes it puts up a challenge, because they can ask the question. It's like, well, it's hard right now. When does it become easy? What do we have to do for it to become easy? And sometimes those are best things, best for story. It's like, so we want to overthrow the king. Well, you're third level characters, and you know, you have to basically get a bunch of people on your side and do that. And it's like, okay, but how do we do that? Right? What, you know, that can create entire campaigns. Yeah, even making it hard can sometimes do exactly what the players want you to do, and that's to create fun in the directions that they want to go. That's the difference between tabletop RPGs and tabletop computer games, is players have a lot of choice in in what they're doing. They can turn around a campaign literally on a dime and force a GM to really rethink what the campaign's about.
Absolutely.
And I think sometimes, too, if you say no too much and you're the type of DM who wants something beyond combat, it becomes hard because a lot of the rules are about combat because that's the time where life and death really starts to come into play. I mean, obviously it varies across editions, but if all the rules are about combat, then it's very hard to have a non-combat game without saying yes to something or designing your own.
No, and that's true. I mean, and I'm a big proponent of, I think you do want to have a very hardcore combat system, just because people want the idea of absolute or nearly absolute fairness in that. If my character can die and if monsters are dying,
right,
I want to know what the hell's going on. But yeah, you can be a lot freer in the skill thing in skill challenges and rules that require or scenarios that require a lot of skill checks, and that gives you a lot of flexibility. It's a lot easier to say yes a lot of times in those situations.
Right.
Right on. Now you mentioned that you allowed Tracy to try to blind the Blindheim with her cloak.
Yes.
In the Pathfinder game the other week. Now, if this was a fourth edition game, how would you have done that?
Oh, let's see.
This will give us an example of how to say yes.
All right, so now I'm going to have to put on my fourth edition hat for a little bit. I think I would have done it the same sort of way. It's like, okay, you have to ask the question, how do I make a basic attack with a cloak? And what does that do? So I think first off we have to start about on how would we make a Blindheim, a classic monster from the old Fiend Folio, in fourth edition, if it's not already there somewhere. And you know, it's really easy. It's got these head beam sort of eyeballs that blind folks. It's done it in just about every edition of the game. It's a kind of a goofy monster, but you know, a lot of the Fiend Folio monsters are. But people have a good time. So yeah, I've got a cloak. Okay, make a melee basic attack. You're not going to be very good at it because unless, you know, your cloak's not really a weapon and your cloak's not really magical. But if you do, not only do you have the thing immobilized, but it stops that attack for as long as you do that. And of course, it can attempt to escape that attack every round.
So you're doing it as a melee basic against which defense? Just against AC?
Probably reflex.
Yeah, I think that.
I mean, it's, you know, what does armor have to do with it? So
right.
I would say a melee basic ish. It's a special melee basic against reflex.
Right.
Yeah.
And then maintain a grapple after that.
Yeah, maintain a grapple after that.
Yeah, there is a grab action in 4E.
Yeah, that's true. I always forget about that one.
I think everybody does.
Players use it.
That's one thing I've found. A lot of those, I just forget that they exist when I'm playing.
Oh, see, now I've had a lot of players ruin my plans with it where I have the intention of a recurring villain escaping a combat, and that's when they remember, oh, yeah, we can grab.
Yeah, most of the time they're looking at the rogues or the wizards to put down enough control to do that. At least in one of my groups, the rogues have a lot of control. I'm sure a lot of rogues out there have a lot of control powers. And so, and both of my games that I run in fourth edition are in High Paragon right now. So nobody looks at the grab general attack anymore. They always look through their bag of tricks.
Right on.
Right.
Now, you mentioned the other thing that you have to do in order to blind a Blindheim in 4th edition is design a Blindheim in 4th edition.
Yeah.
So let's jump into our building segment here where we're going to build something, and we're going to build a 4th edition version of the Blindheim. What the heck is a Blindheim?
All right, so the Blindheim was actually first published, I believe, in White Dwarf magazine back before it was sort of a vehicle for just Games Workshop miniatures and rules, but it was actually a D&D magazine or a fantasy role-playing magazine in England. And they had this thing called the the Fiend Factory, where, you know, people could submit monsters and they would stat them up. And a lot of those monsters ended up populating the Fiend Folio. So it is a subterranean creature. It's a kind of frog-like humanoid with large eyes that shine like searchlights. And it blinds critters. And, you know, that's about it. That's all it really does. And, of course, bites you, right? It's got a bite attack.
And claws, remember?
And, oh, yeah, and claws. And in fourth edition,
that.
Claws. And let's see, I'm looking at the first edition one, and it just says, well, back then it just had damage slash attack, 1d8, so, right. Or 1d8.
So it's a fairly low-level creature that's almost, in appearance anyway, it's almost bullywog-like, except that its eyes glow.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's, and it's paler than a bullywog, so... You know, it's a bullywog that's been living
in the underdark.
Down in the underdark, and yeah, and it has headlights for eyes.
Excellent. So, I mean, I think you're making probably a level 1-2 creature, maybe 3.
Yeah, probably. So blind is a tough condition for overly low. I'd be more tempted to go 3 or 4 level 3 or 4.
Okay. So you go 3 or 4, and it's got some basic just bite and claw attacks.
Yes.
Now, is it going to have one of those combo powers where, you know, it has the basic bite, it has the basic claw, but then it's got the power that lets it do a couple of claws and a bite, or?
Well, I think you have to, let's see, you probably have to ask whether it's a controller or a skirmisher. Okay. And you could, of course, make two different versions of it, one that's a little bit more controlled. Maybe it's blind is harder to get through, or maybe it's blind has some a little bit of psychic damage along with it. Or you could do a skirmisher, which definitely, you know, you give them a sneak attack, a combat advantage attack in there as well. Mm-hmm. And so they blind you, and then they come and jump on you and bite you.
I said, in that case, yeah. I want it to be able to hop.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. We definitely want to give it sort of a hop attack or ability to hop sort of movement form. Uh-huh. Where it can avoid difficult terrain. That way you can stick this guy in the middle of a large mushroom patch that maybe the characters are having a hard time getting to, and it just goes, woohoo! Oh, you're blinded! Wah! Leaps over and starts mauling you.
I was thinking that it should have an aura, but I could be wrong.
What sort of aura?
I was thinking people in the aura grant combat advantage, because most people are going to try, I think... might try to avert their eyes, because that was one of the good things about this encounter, right, was that we had to make that decision between averting our eyes or just trying to make the saving throw against being blinded.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking aura might be cool, but...
Yeah, and the good thing about an aura is you can even put the heavy blind penalty on there as well, but you can also create an aura that sits there and says you can either avert your eyes or... you become blind. If you avert your eyes, you suffer some pretty heavy penalties when attacking the Blindheim, and then even then it starts acting more like a lurker.
Right. Well, and the lurker was the one I would have picked for it, because the original text that I read about describing it said that sometimes it would just shut off its eye and hide out for a little while, and jump out and surprise people.
You could definitely make a really fun lurker. From the Blindheim.
I've been thinking about this a little bit. Sorry.
No, that's fine. And I actually like the idea of doing a few different versions. I like doing a controller that has the aura,
and then
if you're in that aura, you're either looking at the bright lights or you're averting your gaze, and either way, you're at a disadvantage. And so if you're in the aura, you're granted combat advantage. But then meanwhile, you've got a lurker or a skirmisher who's doing extra damage. If it has combat advantage.
Yeah, right, they hunt in packs, so, and other creatures use them for hunting too, so yes. Sorry.
And the great thing about making a lurker is you could create a fairly quick leader, well, I wouldn't probably go as high a solo with this guy, that is the sort of golem sitting in a cave sort of encounter, like, oh, what's the freaky thing going on over there? also... when they fight in packs, having a couple of them that sit towards the edges and really sort of maul at your party, it could be a lot of fun.
Right on. And so, are there any versions of this that have actual gaze attacks that do something a little bit more? Maybe that's where the blindness comes in, or what becomes their shtick that all of them sort of have besides they can hop? And
Well, I think you have to add the blind sometime, whether or not you put it in, kind of hardcore in the aura, just say it's automatic while you're in the aura if you're not averting your eyes, or if you make an actual gaze attack. I think either one could work and would probably require at least a little bit of playtesting to see which one is more fun or which one works with different roles.
But I'm a DM and I'm running it now.
You're a DM and you're running it now.
I can't play test. I'm not publishing anything. I want to know how to make a blind time.
Sure, no, absolutely.
Which one do you do?
I would probably do a mix of both, depending on the role. I'd be very tempted to make an aura that makes you grant combat advantage because of the bright light, and any creature that's granted combat advantage because of the bright light can get zapped with the gaze attack. It sort of limits the ability there, and it acts a little bit more like a controller. It might not be the best way to get your lurker thing done. Mm-hmm. But then I could also add a little bit of psychic damage on to it as well. Right, I'm blinded and it hurts, you know, sort of thing as well. I think I'd probably at least start with that and see how bad it just wrecked my players, and then maybe ask forgiveness after they gave me sour looks when I was done.
But it's a classic monster.
It is a classic monster. And classic monsters tend to sometimes be real gotcha monsters.
Yeah.
And I think part of the fun of the Blindheim is almost like the gelatinous cube. It's a sort of gotcha monster. It's sort of, well, it's definitely not orcs. It's not, you know, beat my head in with a rock. It's doing something dramatically different. And I think you need to kind of keep that aspect of the Blindheim intact.
I think it would be kind of cool to just have them look like frogs at first. And like, oh, they look like cute little frogs. And then, boom!
Oh yeah, boom! They that would be kind of fun. Although I like the whole, walking upright, creepy.
Yeah.
You can get your golem voice going and comes in my cave. It, you know, what does it want and stuff like that. But having it just take on frog form and have sit on a toadstool or something with its eyes closed and wait for the PCs to come up. That's a nice gotcha monster, too.
Cool. Well, do we have anything else to discuss in terms of design of a Blindheim? I mean, without actually statting it out.
No, I think once we figure out the creature type, and it's probably an aberrant, but you could maybe do another type for it as well, is you're basically done. A good thing about a lot of those classic monsters is while they're sort of weird gotcha monsters, they're pretty easy to port over into just about any edition of the game. They don't really have a whole lot going with them, and you don't spend a lot of time wondering what Blindheim society looks like. You just go, well, I mean, if you really sort of thought about the monster, of course you have to make them immune to being blind, because I don't even want to think about how these guys have sex, right? How these guys procreate. It's all, I'm blind. And all of a sudden it's rolling around the floor and it seems really weird. But, but that's the thing about a lot of D&D monsters is they live for 5 minutes.
Right.
And in our imagination. And we don't really have to think too hard about what goes on when adventurers aren't trying to take their stuff.
Especially some of the classic monsters.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, you might really want to get into Hobgoblin society, like what makes Hobgoblin society tick, and there's been a lot of great adventure and supplementary material based on those those kind of things. But yeah, for the most part in your game, you just go, it's a crazy monster, fight it. Ha ha.
Right on. Well, you are invited and welcome to design a Blindheim, and we'd be happy to publish it on the website if you want to. I'm not saying that any other designers have been awesome and done that in fantastic ways, but you're welcome to should the time present itself.
Sure, yeah. That sounds like a lot of fun. I do like the Blindheim.
Right on.
It's quirky.
All right. Well, I think that's our design then.
Cool.
So we want to thank our sponsors, Noble Knight Games, as well as Greater Games and their game Sentinels of the Multiverse. And we want to thank our guest, Stephen Radley McFarland. Where can people go out and find you on the interweb, Stephen?
I have a blog called Neo Grognard at neogrognard.com that I don't update nearly as often as I should. And you can always friend me on Facebook, just Stephen Radley McFarland. I don't have a fan page. You can just come in. As long as you don't mind me putting up a lot of rock and roll and heavy metal and spouting off about my far left politics, you should be fine.
Right on. And you can also get a hold of the show. You can email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com, call into the Tomes Biz Line at 919-BIZTOME, and swing by the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com. Tracy, where can they find the show notes?
Show notes are at thetomeshow.com. And that is episode 185. We survived the flames of the Edition Wars, shared some hard-won advice, found ways to say yes, and blinded you with our eyes in this episode of...
The Tome. I'm on the wall.
The Tome.